And now, it's time for our weekly news round. Lutheran Radio News with Paul Hill.
Valentine's Day was with us this week, with heart-adorned cards, bumper boxes of chocolate, bouquets of red roses, and teddy bears wearing t-shirts emblazoned with cutesy messages in shops across the country. Now heavily commercialised and laden with expectation, the annual event was once a day where people earnestly showed their love and affection for another person. The oldest surviving Valentine's poem was written by a prison-entrapped pining lover, Charles, Duke of Orleans, who wrote it for his wife in 1415 while confined in the Tower of London after being captured at the Battle of Agincourt. However, Valentine's Day was celebrated for centuries before that. From who the saint was to the best romantic gift ideas, here is everything you need to know about St. Valentine's Day. So when is it? The event falls on the same day each year, February the 14th, which this year was a Thursday. Couples across the globe typically recognise the annual celebration by exchanging gifts, flowers and cards, although it isn't a public holiday in every country. While Valentine's Day is now heavily commercialised, the Church originally decided to make the day a Christian celebration to honour St. Valentine. The Feast of St. Valentine of February the 14th was first established in 496 by Pope Gelasius I, who included Valentine among all those whose names are justly reverenced among men, but whose acts are known only to God. While the details of who St. Valentine was are contested, one thing is agreed upon. He was martyred and buried on February the 14th at the Roman cemetery on the Via Flaminia, the ancient road from Rome to Rimini. However, the details we have of St. Valentine's could be of one saint or two conflated saints with the same name. This means there are many different biographies in circulation. The most popular legend is that St. Valentine, a priest from Rome, was arrested after secretly marrying Christian couples who were being persecuted by Emperor Claudius II in the 3rd century AD. As helping Christians was considered a crime, St. Valentine was imprisoned. While in jail, he attempted to convert the emperor to Christianity and was condemned to death. He was beaten with stones and clubs before being beheaded outside the Flaminian Gate. According to some, while in prison, St. Valentine fell in love with the jailer's daughter and sent her a love letter signed "From Your Valentine" on February the 14th, the day of his execution, as a goodbye. Wearing a coronet made from flowers and with a stenciled inscription, St. Valentine's skull now resides in the Chiesa di Santa Maria in Cosmedine on Rome's Piazza Bocca della Verità. A casket containing a number of St. Valentine's bones and a vial of his blood have been stored in the Whitefriars Street Church in Dublin since 1936, and couples regularly visit the religious shrine to ask him to watch over their lives. Many couples preparing to marry also head to this church on February the 14th, the feast day for the saint, for a blessing of the rings in the presence of the reliquary. And what's Cupid got to do with it all? Well, Cupid is the god of desire, erotic love, attraction and affection. He is often portrayed as the son of the love goddess Venus and the war god Mars. Cupid is also known in Latin as Amor, love. His Greek counterpart is Eros, and he is just one of the ancient symbols associated with St. Valentine's Day, along with the shape of a heart, doves and the colours red and pink. He is usually portrayed as a small winged figure with a bow and arrow, which he uses to strike the hearts of people. People who fall in love are said to be struck by Cupid's arrow. The heart was once associated with knowledge as well as feelings. Egyptians believed that the heart was the source of our memories as well as our emotions. They placed so much value on the organ that they left it in people's bodies during mummification, while throwing all the other organs, including the brain, away. And they weren't the only ones. Aristotle also believed that the heart was an organ of intellect. This idea was widely accepted until Galen, a Roman physician, said the heart was more likely to be responsible for emotions than reason, apart from love, which was found in the liver. As the influence of Christianity grew in the Middle Ages, so did the religion's pairing of the heart with love, courtly love, where knights wooed women, became popular in the 11th century and was tied to spiritual attainment. It became popularized in lyric poems written by troubadours, such as William of Aquitaine, one of the first troubadour poets. Some say he was likely influenced by similar views on love in the Islamic world, where he came into contact with during the First Crusade. In 1184, poet Andreas Calpurnius referred to the organ as one of affection, writing, "the pure love which binds together the hearts of two lovers with every feeling of delight." Around the same time, members of European families began to insist their hearts were buried separately from the rest of their bodies, in places that were special to them. In 1199, King Richard I of England had his heart buried in Rouen in Normandy and his body in Anjou, where his father was buried. Over the centuries, the idea that the heart is linked to emotion has persisted, and the two are now intrinsically linked. It was during the middle of the 18th century that Valentine's Day started to take off in England, with lovers sending sweets and cards adorned with flowers, ribbons, and images of cupids and birds. Eventually, huge numbers of printed cards replaced handwritten ones. In 1913, Hallmark Cards of Kansas City began mass-producing Valentine's Day cards. Now, about 1 billion Valentine's Day cards are exchanged every year, and it's the second largest seasonal card to sending time of the year. A Catholic farmhand wrongly convicted and sentenced to death for blasphemy finally faces freedom after Pakistan's Supreme Court removed the last legal barrier to her release. Pakistan's top court last week dismissed the petition against Asia Bibi's acquittal last year, apparently leaving her free to leave the country and seek asylum abroad. The decision by a three-man bench headed by Chief Justice Asir Safid Khoza ends a 10-year deal. The mother of five was wrongly sentenced to hang in 2010 after she was accused of defaming the Prophet Muhammad during a quarrel with fellow villagers. Mrs. Bibi spent 8 years on death row in a case which deeply divided Pakistan, highlighting both its harsh blasphemy laws and mistreatment of minority Christians. Two senior politicians who tried to help her and reform the laws were assassinated by religious hardliners. Authorities prepared for more trouble ahead of the ruling, stepping up security around the court and readying paramilitary police to be deployed across the capital, Islamabad. Saif al-Maluk, Mrs. Bibi's lawyer, said the decision to reject the petition was a victory for justice in Pakistan. He said his client would now enjoy a relaxed rest of a life abroad. He praised the Supreme Court judges for finding in favour of his client despite death threats against them. He said, "Pakistan's Supreme Court has proved that they are a better court than the Supreme Court in America." The Supreme Court demolished a case against Mrs. Bibi in October, complaining of flimsy evidence, contradictory testimony by her accusers, and irregularities in the prosecution. But her acquittal sparked 3 days of protest by the hardline religious Tehreek-e-Labik Pakistan TLP party. As roads were blocked, schools closed, and commerce disrupted, the government reached a deal saying it would allow a petition to review the decision and keep Mrs. Bibi in the country. Following the protest, police arrested radical clerics Kadim Hussain Rizvi and Muhammad Afzal Qadri, both leaders of the Tehreek-e-Labik party, and they remain in custody. The TLP said on Monday it would not accept the release of Mrs. Bibi and told supporters to prepare for more protest, but the detention of its leaders may rein in the anger. Mrs. Bibi has remained in protective custody ahead of the hearing. She and her family say they are not safe in Pakistan, where religious groups continue to call for her execution. Residents of the village where she lived and was accused told The Telegraph last month they have not forgiven her and believe she must still hang. Her supporters disclosed in November that vigilantes were trying to find her relatives, knocking door to door in their neighbourhood. Mrs. Bibi's two daughters have already fled to Canada with their guardian, and the country is a leading contender to give her asylum. Justin Trudeau, Canadian Prime Minister, said last year the country was in talks with Pakistan and said Canada is a welcoming country. Wilson Chowdhury, chairman of the British Pakistani Christian Association, said, "Today is a day of rejoicing, come what may, in the aftermath of this decision. Asia Bibi has always been innocent, and it is a blight on Pakistan that it took almost 10 years to come to this decision to free her." A medieval nun faked her own death and ran away from her convent to escape a life of celibacy and pursue a life of carnal lust. Joan of Leeds was living at the house of St. Clement by York in 1318 when she decided to enlist the help of her fellow sisters to create a dummy which would represent her corpse and slip away into the night. The ruse was foiled by the Archbishop of the time, who ordered her to return to a life of poverty and obedience and abandon her newly adopted way of carnal lust. It remains unknown if the nun returned to the Institute or continued her renegade life of freedom in what researchers call a frustrating outcome. Researchers at the University of York discovered a note written in Latin buried within the pages of one of the 16 registers used to log the activities of the Archbishops of York between 1304 and 1405. The comical charade was described by Professor Sarah Rees-Jones, Director for Medieval Studies at York University and lead researcher for the project, as extraordinary, like a Monty Python sketch. Archbishop William Melton penned a note in Latin to the runaway nun which read, "To warn Joan of Leeds, lately nun in the house of St. Clement by York, that she should return to her house," the Guardian reports. He also sent an additional letter to the Dean of Beverley to tell him of the rogue nun's shenanigans. In his note, he slandered the promiscuous nun and spoke of her scandalous behaviour. Further assassination of her character include claims that she impudently cast aside the propriety of religion and the modesty of her sex. He added, "Out of a malicious mind simulating a bodily illness, she pretended to be dead, not dreading for the health of her soul, and with the help of numerous of her accomplices, evildoers with malice aforethought, crafted a dummy in the likeness of her body, in order to mislead the devoted faithful, and she had no shame in procuring its burial in a sacred space among the religious of that place." He also spoke of the discovery of the nun's deceit and the outrage it caused. Archbishop Melton continued, "In a cunning, nefarious manner, having turned her back on decency and the good of religion, seduced by indecency, she involved herself irreverently and perverted her path of life arrogantly to the way of carnal lust and away from poverty and obedience, and, having broken her vows and discarded the religious habit, she now wanders at large to the notorious peril to her soul and to the scandal of all of her order." The text recorded the unfolding of the events, but did not include any information as to if the scandal was ever resolved. "Unfortunately, and this is really frustrating, we don't know the outcome of the case," said Professor Rees-Jones. "There are quite a lot of cases of monks and nuns who left their religious house. We don't always get the full detail or know what the outcome was. Researchers hope to translate the contents of all 16 books and make their contents available online in a bid to learn more about the church during the Middle Ages. Archbishop Melton is an intriguing character that the investigators want to learn more about, as he spearheaded an army of priests and members of the public in a battle against the Scots in 1319, only a year after the saga with Joan of Leeds. Officials in the employ of the Archbishop would carry the last sheets of parchment and reveal a turbulent time as the religious community recoiled from the outbreak of the Black Death. Priests at this time often read last rites to the infected and often became afflicted themselves, making the profession one of the most dangerous in the UK at that time." Professor Rees-Jones said, "Because so many priests had died, there weren't enough people trained in Latin, so delivering sermons in English had to be adopted as the new status quo. The registers may shed new light on what it was like to live through this period, and will perhaps give us a sense of how the church reasserted its authority after such catastrophic events." Catholic children are being squeezed out of their local faith school after a council decided to allocate places by ballot rather than religion. St. Andrew's Academy in Paisley has turned away Catholic children from local non-denominational primary schools and admitted Protestants and children of other faiths or none who won through the ballot. A Renfrewshire Council official picked names out of an envelope, a process angry parents have described as a tombola that separates siblings and friends. Children from the 7 Catholic primary schools in the catchment area are still given first preference. For Catholics whose parents chose to send them to a non-denominational primary school were put into the ballot. John Kelly, chairman of St Andrew's Academy Parent Council, said that parents were promised the school would be big enough to accommodate all Catholics in the catchment area when it moved to a new building in 2006. We wrote to the council a few years ago asking if they could expand the school, but they said it would be too costly, he said. It's a public-private partnership building, so it would cost the earth to expand, so everyone has known for years this would happen. St Andrew's was rated very good for attainment and well-being after an inspection in August. Carol Ann Davison, councillor for Paisley East and Central, said that parents were concerned and worried sick about their children, many of whom have older siblings already attending St Andrew's. Renfrewshire Council said it was committed to providing the best teaching environment possible to allow children to reach their full potential regardless of which school they attend. It added, due to unprecedented demand, the maximum number of places in S1 at St Andrew's is oversubscribed, and in line with our policy for school admissions, all pupils who attend the associated catchment primary schools have been allocated a place, unless they attend this school as a result of a placing request. All other families who asked for a place at St Andrew's were entered into a ballot to determine the remaining places, which was undertaken by a member of the council's internal audit team to ensure fairness and transparency. Neil Bibby, MSP for West of Scotland, said, "Solutions need to be found for the placing request problem. I encourage the council to meet with parents and work together to find a solution for the short, medium and long term." Faced with huge bills to repair their crumbling spires, leaky roofs and weathered gargoyles, the country's churches and cathedrals have had to seek help from on high. Not from God, but from drones. Britain's largest insurer of church buildings has started deploying the aircraft to perform aerial surveys, using a bird's-eye view to assess the extent of damage and deterioration to features that are too lofty to be safely reached by ladder or even abseiling surveyors. The cost of repairing and maintaining a 900-year-old cathedral can spiral into the millions of pounds, but it could also be expensive and dangerous to carry out surveys, as inspectors need access to spires, towers and turrets hundreds of feet above ground. The insurance group Ecclesiastical has brought in drones as part of a trial to assess the condition of the churches and cathedrals it insures. The group has used the technology on two Church of England buildings and a school and will extend its trial to other sites. The spokesman said, "So far the technology has revealed damaged and loose high-level slates, tiles and stonework and missing pointing." The oldest parts of Worcester Cathedral date back almost 1,000 years to 1084, with other parts added over subsequent centuries. It costs £7,500 per day to maintain the cathedral, which has spent more than £800,000 on repairs to internal elements such as the medieval ceiling in its library and its Great West Window in recent years. Work to its 62-metre tower has had to wait, however, as it has proved too expensive and difficult to carry out a full survey. The internal stonework of the tower dates back to the 14th century, but it was refaced in the 19th century. The future King Charles II is said to have watched the Battle of Worcester from the top of the tower during the Civil War in 1651. "We were conscious that parts of the tower needed to be inspected, but the cost and logistical challenges of doing this meant we had not been able to do so," Val Floyd, the cathedral's chief operating, said. "The imagery captured by the drone will enable us to do an initial assessment so we can prioritise future work and inspections." St Hilda's, the church in Halifax, was built in 1911. It is aiming to raise at least £15,000 owing to the urgent need for extensive work to be carried out on the fabric of our roof, according to the parochial church council. The Reverend Caroline Greenwood, the church's vicar, said, "We've known about issues with the church's guttering for some time, but haven't been able to get up to the roof to inspect them properly. Now we have really clear pictures of the problem and we can submit the photographs as part of our grant application, and hopefully that will strengthen our case." Mark Matthews, Risk Management Director at Ecclesiastical, said that the ancient buildings presented unique challenges when it came to maintenance. They often face particular difficulties in trying to access precarious spires and pinnacles that reach up to the heavens. The use of drone technology provides access to high-quality imagery and very accurate data, which can be difficult to obtain via traditional survey methods. The insurance group also used a drone to assess a school in southern England and said they received a shock when the drone revealed a number of footballs, rugby balls and tennis balls sitting on the roof of its new sports hall, blocking the gutters. A spokesman said the technology could help churches to obtain more accurate information when deciding how best to protect and preserve their buildings. He added, the data gathered from the drones will also enable ecclesiastical to calculate reinstatement or restoration values with more certainty, reducing the risk of underinsurance for its customers. The National Churches Trust has used Heritage Lottery Fund money to explore the use of unmanned aerial vehicles to survey churches using drones to produce 3D computer images of buildings. One church in North Yorkshire had to cut short a drone survey of damage caused by pigeons in 2015, however, when they were warned that the operator had not received permission from the Civil Aviation Authority. The battle to preserve ancient churches has led to an arms race amid reports that gangs of organised criminals have used drones to identify which churches have lead roofs ripe for theft. And finally, there was a new pastor who wanted to rent a house in the country. The only house available was rumoured to be haunted. Since the pastor didn't believe in such things, he rented it. It wasn't long before the ghost made its appearance. The pastor told his friends about the ghost, but they didn't believe him. They told him the only way they would believe it if he would take a picture of the ghost. The pastor went to his home and called for the ghost. When it appeared, the pastor explained the situation and asked the ghost if it would mind having its picture taken. The ghost agreed. When the picture was developed, the ghost wasn't visible. Feeling very disappointed, the pastor called again for the ghost. When it appeared, the pastor showed it the picture and wanted to know why the ghost wasn't in it. The ghost thought for a minute and replied, "Well, I guess the spirit was willing, but the flesh was weak." My name is Paul Hill. Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. Lutheran Radio News will be back next Friday. Until then, every blessing to you and goodbye for now.
On your PC, tablet, mobile phone and internet radio receiver, this is Lutheran Radio UK.